Hello. Good night. Good evening. I got something for you.
I'm ready. Yes.
Okay. So you and I, we have different genres of beloved reality television.
For sure.
I'm a Bachelor fandom watcher, and then I watch like some cooking reality. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
And I just binge Tampa Bay's. Yeah.
Yeah, and Jamie's out here, like, Tampa Bay's, Bad Girls Club, fucking Real Housewives. Although,
brief pause, Tampa Bay's really scratched, like, a Bad Girls Club itch that I didn't know I still had. But yeah, I love the Real Housewives franchises.
Yeah, I'm like, these are the genres that you care about.
I just want women on television being in delusional. That's what I want. 90 Day Fiancé, same deal. Sorry, go ahead.
Exactly. Okay, so this is in that genre of delusional women on television. Because I want to talk to you about something someone was reporting on from Wife Swap.
I love Wife Swap is like my first reality love.
You're feeling it. You're feeling it on the inside. I know you. So did you know that there is a family that was featured on Wife Swap that one of the children ultimately kills the mom, his mom, who was featured on this show, and one of his brothers.
I did not. I knew that there was, like, some... I've seen an episode of something called, like, Wife Swap Murder, and, like, I didn't watch it for some reason. So, like, this is vaguely familiar, but I was thinking it was, like, the husband or something. No, I didn't know it was the kid. Is it King Curtis?
I think King Curtis is, like, that, like, guy who's, like, a rapper, right? Like, the son who's, like, I want to be a rapper.
Oh, no. King Curtis is like a 7-year-old with a really bad attitude.
Okay, it's not him. Then yeah. I'm wrong. Now I'm just confusing rap names, and for that I apologize.
That's okay. King Curtis wishes he was this person you're talking about.
Probably. For anyone looking for this, it is season 4, episode 15, A Wife Swap, and this shit's on Hulu.
Thank you.
So, no, there's one family where, like, the parents are, like, just very, how do I want to say, like, they're, like, the looser, more bohemian. They have, like, a son who's, sure, like, a rapper. He's, like, you know, there's a lot of swearing. His, like, girlfriend lives with the family. And then the other family's, like, very Christian. And, like, the kids have to, like, do all these chores for, like, tokens in this really structured way to, like, even be allowed to, like, they have to, like, you know, earn 20 tokens by doing, like, 20 chores to get, like, 20 minutes of listening to, like, the radio.
Oh, my God. Okay. Yeah, I've seen episodes like that, if not this one.
Yeah, and one of the sons from that conservative family, it's not the oldest, it's like the middle son. He grows up to, and he kills his mom, his younger brother, and then he attempts to, like, shoot. I mean, I don't know all the details of the crime, but he shoots himself.
Oh my God.
But does not kill himself. And so, ensuing trial, all of the things. I think
trial, like, right now is coming up. Like, this is more kind of recent.
So I think this incident, I think, happened in 2018.
Okay. Yeah, I'm thinking it's like 2010. So yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, but I feel like court stuff is still coming to fruition. I think he ultimately, like, at some point changed his plea to guilty, but, like, insanity or something. Obviously, there was, like, a lot of, you know, repression in the household.
Absolutely.
But I was like, man, what an intersection of things you and people in our generation cared about, i.e. Wife Swap and Wife Swap suddenly becoming, like, an episode of true crime.
Mm-hmm.
Also, welcome to Why Are You Like This?
Welcome.
Speculating wildly. Sure. A sex manual, you know, from the 17th century.
And remember, the greatest myth about the moon is that America went there in Apollo 11. Good night. Good night.
Well, yeah, I would slice my hand open for moisturizer.
Well, we've brought it back to blood magic somehow.
It's franchising our platform. We're franchising it, okay?
They're going to break your legs and feed you to the sharks.
No, fuck Barnes & Noble. I never cared about them. I'd throw hands at Dan Brown, okay?
The handsome snakes with wings fucked the women all night. Nobody ever talks about that passage.
Welcome. Why Are You Like This is the weekly podcast where we dissect some part of our culture, human behavior, pseudoscience, the families on wife swap, just whatever mm-hmm. we're noodling on at any given time, in order to determine why people are the way that they are. That's Jamie Ryan watching Tampa Bay's, but prepping to queue up this old episode of Wife Swap in Los Angeles.
And that's Austin Williams providing me with these Wife Swap numerical codes that I need in Chicago.
And you know what? I just want to say to the listeners out there that I consistently watch The Bachelor not live to bring you this this content here at Why Are You Like This, okay? Do with that what you will, okay? We all make sacrifices for our family, okay?
We do. And I actually have to add, rolling off of a reality show turned true crime situation.
Oh, shit.
That the Real Housewives franchises recently have slid into true crime territory with most predominantly Erica Girardi, wife of, or former wife of Tom Girardi. And that huge thing happening, and also Jen Shaw of Salt Lake City getting arrested for fraud, and that being like a major season arc. And so, yeah, that franchise is kind of like tiptoeing towards true crime, which I think is interesting.
Well, dude, it's so real. And I, as someone who's never watched a full episode of any of the Real Housewives franchises, nothing against it, just never something I've settled into. I've repeatedly watched the clip where, what is it, Girardi?
Erica.
Erica. Where, like, she gets tipped off that the police are coming for her and, like, rapidly unmics herself on that party bus and, like,
oh, that's vanishes. Jen Shaw. Sorry, that's Jen Shaw on Salt Lake. Oh, that's
Jen Shaw.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I've she lies. I watched that
clip repeatedly.
Oh, my God. I saw that episode aired last night as we record this. And Jen Shaw, yeah, rapidly unmics when that happens. But then she runs back onto the bus and tells everyone on the bus that her husband is in the hospital with internal bleeding and that she has to leave right now. And so she leaves. And then, like, 2 minutes later, like,
the police show up.
Yes. And Homeland Security. And one of the housewives is like,
Homeland Security. Like, can you even?
And one of the housewives is like, should I call Jen? And the other one is like, I don't think you should call Jen. Like, to tell She's her like, that they're coming. No. Okay. I'm done.
She but was this like, should I tip her off? That's fucking tight, honestly. I just want you to know that if the police were coming for you, I would try to figure out a way to tip you off.
I would figure out a way to not, yeah, entangle myself in it. But I would try to tell you. Anyway, sorry. This is me getting sucked in.
We'd have to use, like, burner phones, and Jamie, like, definitely isn't ever near her phone, nor would she, like, try and respond from an unknown number, but...
No, and I have a bag that I put my phone in that's, like, a black hole that makes it undetectable. Anyway, I'm not here to talk about that, and I'm also really getting sucked into the Housewives true crime now, so sorry for derailing you.
No, I loved it. Honestly, I'm like, I'm not a Housewives watcher, and I've still watched that clip before it even aired.
My God, repeatedly. It's
amazing. I think probably on TikTok, where she's just like, I gotta go. And I'm like, what is happening with this person?
She's the most intense person also.
I love it. Whew. And tonight, this evening, this morning, this afternoon, whenever you're listening to this, I'm happy to report, actually, the things we're discussing aren't totally a black hole. I mean, we're not here to talk more about wife swap, unless we can figure out a way to. I'm open to it.
I will or work the housewives. It in.
Yeah, work it in. But we are here to talk about true crime.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Namely, I think some of the stuff I want to get into is, like, I mean, true crime has always, like, been a phenomenon. And I know, Jamie, you've got some just, like, interesting tidbits, I think, on times in history where it's been popular. But we definitely are feeling the surgence of it, you know, a resurgence, a big focus. And specifically in the podcast lane, but also, like, television. And if you're, you know, one of our brethren, we're definitely people who have been enamored in this. I always think about the time we rented from Blockbuster, which gives you a timestamp of how long we've been doing this, a Ted Bundy movie that was so... Was it Bundy or... It was Dahmer. Was it Bundy or Dahmer?
all different. We did like a little kick, and we were kind of, at least to my knowledge, because we were like in high school and early college at this time.
Mm-hmm.
We were like a little ahead of the game on like seeking this out. So yeah, we were going to Blockbuster and we rented, yes, the Ted Bundy thing, because I remember.
Let's be honest though, we might have been at a Family Video. Okay.
And I wasn't going to correct you, but it was Family Video in Finneytown.
Okay, tight.
Before it was like attached to Little Caesars.
I guess what the ones that I'm between are, there was one that we watched, and I think it was
We watched Dahmer at one point, and BTK, and Ted Bundy.
But there was one that was so scary, and it was either Dahmer or Bundy, that it was just a dramatic reenactment, and it was so terrifying.
It was Bundy, and I remember this scene. It was when he has that woman chained up.
That girl in the cave.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she runs, he acts like he's going to let her run away, but the chain is still around her, and you just see, yeah, yeah, it's very upsetting.
Dude, I still think about that
the other day when I was on a hike in California, which is the same setting as that.
That seems similar.
Right, right, right. And there was like a sort of concrete opening. There's like tons of those out here, I guess for drainage or something. And like instantly in my mind, that scene flashed. So I never fucking forgot either. And it's weird we're talking about it just a few days later.
Damn. Damn, man. See, there's a bunch of stuff to this, and it feels forever relevant. And I don't know, maybe we'll get into some of the psychology of why you were maybe thinking about that in a similar setting. But just at the top of the episode, I do feel like it's always a good idea to define what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Because, like, what does true crime encompass?
Mm-hmm.
A great question. So, according to our best friends at Wikipedia, true crime is a nonfiction literary podcast and film genre in which the author examines an actual crime and details the actions of real people. So the crimes commonly include murder, but don't have to. It's an important note. And about 40% of tales focus on serial killers.
Mm.
So true crime comes in a lot of forms, books, films, podcasts, television shows. And then a lot of the, you know, big works in this genre recount high profile sensational crimes. So like ones that come immediately to mind that have always been kind of a focus, even if you were somebody who wasn't like really trying to indulge in true crime, would be like JonBenet Ramsey or the O.J. Simpson trial.
Yeah.
And then there are other ones that are like more obscure. And again, it doesn't have to be murder. I think one of the best true crime shows, in my opinion, is I Survived, because it's people who experience crimes, who lived, and they're telling the story themselves. So that's always, we'd love to see it. More on the impact of that later, people telling their own stories versus other people telling them. Because that's the thing that we're going to get into. You know, true crime obviously can impact the crimes they cover and also the audience that consumes it, but it can also be insensitive to victims, survivors, their families. And, you know, some people think of it as like a pretty trashy or, I don't know, bad, negative.
Maybe like a lowbrow kind of media to consume.
Yeah, or things that are just like unhealthy, if you will, or insensitive. I mean, I don't have a better word for it. Insensitive, disrespectful, all the things. But I wanted to start with maybe talking a little bit about why people are interested in true crime.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe we can kind of cite why we think we're interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
But there was an article I found that was like a think piece just on NBC's website. And the headline of it is, why do we love true crime and is it healthy for us?
Mm.
And so this is one that came out recently in June 2021, so it feels like a real current kind of analysis of, you know, thoughts on this, right?
Mm-hmm. But, and the world has changed a lot in the last couple of years, so it's good to have a current resource for this.
Yeah, 100%.
Our fears are
but
different.
And so the article itself was written by a psychotherapist, F. Diane Barth, so welcome to the program, Diane. Yeah. F. Diane.
F. Welcome, F.
I hope that the F stands for fuck. I don't know. I hope that wasn't disrespectful. I just was kind of rooting for that
kind
of power.
Yeah.
You know. So she kind of starts out the article just talking about how books, TV shows, movies, documentaries, and now podcasts, again, like meta in that we're on a podcast talking about true crime, and because that's, it's really popped off, you think about.
But I don't think podcasts would have done that well without true crime as like an intro genre to like the platform.
I think a lot of it is, I don't know that they wouldn't have done well, but I think part of the reason, this is my own theory, I'm deviating from F. Diane for a second, the first real, like, popular, everyone's listening podcast that, like, you didn't have to be a podcast fan to be aware of it in the cultural zeitgeist was Serial.
Correct.
And I would credit that, everyone being into that, being that it was really good storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And if it had been something not true crime, if somebody else had just told another story really well, I think that it's possible that podcasts could have ended up like less true crime heavy because people would have like bandwagoned on something else. But it also makes sense to me that like true crime is something that's like very fitting for the podcast genre because
it's nice to not have a visual.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It leaves a lot of space for the imagination, and it is, you know, sensational and things that are really shocking. And if you're somebody who, you know, is chasing suspense or horror or thrill, I think that stuff oftentimes
are your best tool.
Exactly. So Diane starts out talking about, you know, all the stuff, you know, in real life crime having been popular for years. But there was an SNL live skit called Murder Show from earlier that season, like this, you know, past year, like 2021.
Sure, yeah.
That so cleverly highlighted it as a guilty pleasure, like slightly dirty, never discussed. Adweek, however, at the time, like, noted that there'd been a dramatic increase in the genre over the past 12 months. So, you know, Why Did You Kill Me? White Boy, This Is a Robbery, The World's Biggest Art Heist. And so, again, it doesn't have to be murder. Like, art heist, that's true crime.
Yeah, and a lot of fraud ones came out in the last year and a half, too.
100%. One of my favorite true crime podcasts is Scam Goddess.
Mm-hmm.
Which she's just talking about scammers
every day,
which is, it's truly delightful. But Murder Among the Mormons and Crime Scene, that The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel. So all of those cracked the top 10 most popular shows on Netflix.
Mm.
And Forbes noted that the biographical documentary, The Sons of Sam, A Descent into Darkness, was briefly the number one show on Netflix when it premiered in May.
Mm.
So, I mean, we're not just talking like people are talking about it, but like these things are like power primary ranking consumption. Exactly.
The first, yeah. Everybody's go-to. Wow.
New York Times bestseller lists in their lane, you know?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
So obviously, with all that said, there are still a lot of folks that worry that consuming true crime stories is, you know, psychologically unhealthy, potentially re-traumatizing for survivors of violent crimes on the one hand, and desensitizing viewers and readers to the real meanings of these behaviors on the other.
Mm.
So fucking Diane, F. Diane, our girl.
Yeah, yeah.
She says, as a psychotherapist, I generally assume something so popular must have some mental health implications. Well, so sure, she started asking questions and discovered that many people she knows are secret fans of the genre or could connect her to someone who was. And she learned that while there can be some sense that you're watching out of curiosity, like rubbernecking after a car accident, there's also a lot of psychological, quote, stuff going on.
Sure, yeah. The brain's pretty active. Yeah.
Yeah, it feels right. So one of the examples she gave was this woman named Lauren Jacobson, who had been watching true crime since she was a teenager. And I was like, ahem, that's like us.
Here we are, yeah.
But told Diane that it seems odd, but she falls asleep better when she's listening to the podcast, My Favorite Murder, which I know a lot of people who do that, and I've done that.
Anecdotally, so, I've heard other people do that. I am not able to do that, but yeah, go for it.
And I think I would, yeah, I think some of that is like, I would say, you know, it's, I think probably more the conversational nature of the host that people like feel friendly with them rather than the nature of the things they're always describing that make it something that's like somebody's bedtime zone. It's like listening to homies.
Totally. I think that that is probably that with My Favorite Murder. But there are also people who I have known, multiple people in my life, who watch horror movies when they go to sleep. Like,
can't imagine.
And yeah, it's mind blowing to me.
Well, that's real. She also had a writer, Kelly Sue Donwick, so Captain Marvel, Bitch Planet, she wrote those, similarly told Diane that true crime podcasts soothed her around the start of the Trump administration and then ramped up at the start of the pandemic, which I'm like, interesting.
I feel like we're always like wanting to watch worse shit. It's like the reason why I watch 90 Day Fiancé, I think, is because like I like to watch people who are like worse at love than me and like more delusional about their life than me. And so like true crime sometimes feels like this is maybe has a flavor of what I'm experiencing, but it's much, much worse.
Yes. And it's kind of like how we talked about on a recent FUPdate, like post-Christianity vibes, that people are like obsessed with cult stuff. And listen, 100%. Cult documentaries, that's true
also
crime.
True crime. Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Religious crimes.
Yeah. And so then there's the like, oh, it's something I know a little bit, but like ratchet it up.
Oh, wow. And isn't that how we love everything? It's like Uno style. It's like one thing the same, one thing new. Sorry, go on.
That's real. So Melinda Swan, another person interviewed. So we got a lot of just players in here. Mm-hmm. She, on the other hand, said these shows are fascinating because they show other real life humans and they open the door to how others live. And I would argue that's why people like reality TV show. Mm-hmm. Just like pull true crime out of it. Just like any sort of reality TV show that's like it's like Keeping Up with the Joneses. It's people want a peek into other people's lives. It's gossip magazines.
The original slogan of the Housewives, like all franchises, was that people wanted to see how the other half live.
Right.
Yeah. It's less than half, but yeah.
Totally. There was a man Diane spoke with who wished to remain anonymous, which I love, who said, it's entertainment, which is horrible to say, but it's also fascinating to see how an investigative journalist can dig beneath the surface and put pieces together to come up with a new answer to a crime that was unsolved or solved incorrectly. And that I really agree with. And I enjoy watching somebody else or hearing the narrative of how people can puzzle through things.
Mm-hmm. And it's like very satisfying. And I think that it like scratches the like puzzling itch that a lot of us have, but like also adds the excitement of like danger. People do those fake like solve murder puzzles where you like go around your city, and it's an adult activity. I don't know, I don't remember. You can buy it for a loved one. It's like a murder mystery for your friend to solve.
Okay
But yeah, there's an itch for that in a puzzle way.
Yeah, I mean, it's people have enjoyed reading mystery thrillers for forever.
Right,
so.
Agatha Christie, who I will do an episode on. Yes.
Ooh, put a pin in that.
She had
one,
a dissociative fugue, woke up somewhere else, had a different life, then one day was like, this isn't who I am, and went back to being Agatha Christie. That's for another time.
God bless her, honestly. truly can't wait. But Diane wanted to pose the question about what could make media about violence feel so calming, which I think is an important question.
Let's find out. Yeah.
Yeah. So she went on to say that a pervasive sense of helplessness, which many people have. And I was like, I feel like that's even more pertinent that you think about the pandemic and civil unrest and all these elections where people are like, I've done things, but like, it's, you know, still things are going to happen.
There's no rules
like
for the government anymore. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. You know, maybe there was a coup, we used to say.
Call it what you want.
100%. And so people have felt that, you know, for plenty of years, and some only for the past few months is what she said in June. But it can be modified or even lifted, that feeling of helplessness, by seeing someone else speak about their pain and have it recognized, which I thought was interesting.
It's like validation by proxy.
Totally. And so Kathleen Check, a psychotherapist in Chicago with whom Diane spoke, said that true crime media provided a particular kind of escapism during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But she also added that tuning in and following the specifics of a crime also creates a false sense of being able to, quote, like, see inside the mind of a criminal, thus creating a psychological protective barrier of, like, if I know how criminals operate, I can protect myself. And I think we can get into it more, but I do think that was something that I thought was really interesting. And we'll talk a little bit more about this because there is a lot of, like, there's a very large, like, female, you know, and femme identifying audience for mm-hmm. true crime. Mm-hmm. And the idea of self-defense and how to defend themselves or how to look for red flags seems to be a big motivator about why maybe women continue to, like, tune into this.
Totally. 100%.
She also spoke with a guy named Rick Nizzardini, whose last name I would like.
Good job.
Who is a licensed social worker in San Fran. And he said that those shows touch on the hallmark events of trauma, a sense of powerlessness, a shattering of our sense of safety in the world, and the violation of attachments to family, friends, and community. He also added that this can raise emotions to the surface that often feel dissociated or cut off from processing, but can be helpful for recovery in the right context, which I thought was interesting.
That is fascinating, and I feel like that's definitely true.
Say more.
It just makes a ton of sense to me in kind of like a almost like an EMDR kind of way, that if you have some instance of trauma that's not dealt with, that isn't really ever being triggered that much in your everyday life, I could see it just kind of sitting under the surface and maybe like causing anxieties, but like not ever coming up fully. And so to watch this, it's like deciding like I'm going to be emotionally triggered in this way. And if you're someone who maybe has undealt with trauma that is like the content maybe is related to, I could see how you're like perhaps intentionally triggering yourself as like a catharsis, like a purge of emotions to like maybe process something that feels bad inside of you. And like, I don't think that it's that cognizant. I think that it's a subconscious decision and people are just drawn to true crime and don't realize why. But I could see how it would be kind of a way to not necessarily soothe, but to like access your trauma and like maybe feel a little bit like resolve about it depending on how the media played out or like your mood afterward, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think that's very real and also like an interesting thing to try and wrap your head around.
Yeah. No, totally.
And she also, you know, got the insight that several fans of true crime expressed feeling like both blessed and guilty, knowing that their lives are better than those of the people featured in true crime media, which is like honest. And she said that perhaps some of that guilt might be alleviated by knowing that studies show some survivors feel like true crime puts a voice to feelings and experiences that are not widely heard in our society. So, for example, in a study of domestic violence survivors who listen to true crime podcasts, Kelly Bowling, who's an assistant professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, found that survivors felt they had become part of, quote, a collective identity and a virtual community where their voices are heard and their stories are normalized.
And I think that people, like, just anecdotally from, like, some cult documentaries that I've watched have found similar community in like a survivor's network, like around true crime.
Sure.
But I would think that like, for some reason, it feels like easier to do that if you left a cult than if you were like almost killed. I don't know why, but it does.
I feel that. Yeah. Because it's based in community to begin with.
Ooh, wow. Good catch. Yeah.
So still, obviously, the disturbing nature of true crime can sometimes create problems for people who consume it.
Sure.
Nizzardini, the social worker homie, said that a concern is if a viewer becomes overly triggered without having a support system to discuss and process these feelings, you know, memories or somatic symptoms. Mm-hmm. And so folks in the mental health field know that speaking one's pain out loud, having one's voice heard and experiences validated, and seeing others, you know, conquer their figurative dragons can be soothing and healing. But it's also important to protect oneself from being overwhelmed or overly distressed, of course. Mm-hmm. And each of the fans that fucking Diane spoke with told her that there were shows they did not watch because they hit too close to home or because they were too disturbing.
Yes.
And that knowing your limits and setting boundaries is an important way of managing painful overstimulation, which I totally vibe with because there's stuff that I'm like, ooh, that's too scary. I'm like,
mm-mm. And that has changed for me over time. Like, I don't really watch like murder documentaries very often anymore, unless it's like I watch Murder on Middle Beach because that was like an investigation that a boy was doing into his own family. But
yeah,
like gorier things, like I really have no appetite for anymore. Or things that are like maybe overly centric around like a serial killer, I'm no longer like able to watch. I feel like in a way that like when I was younger, I used to like be able to just consume that shit like endlessly. But it starts to make me feel just like uneasy generally.
And maybe some of that's like, I don't know, probably the development of our brains and sure. That like invincibility of being young and like, you're not like, this is going to happen to me. You're just like, this is crazy. And I feel like horror, the you know, that genre, and then also true crime, like, generally do have a younger audience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And no, it's probably too. Because I think the main audience for a lot of true crime podcasts is, like, women, like, 18 to 35-ish, which is younger.
Yes, based on some other information I have from work, that is an accurate reading.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it makes sense, too, because it's like some other people think like you live more life and more things hit too close to home because you've seen more fucked up shit. And also maybe things that used to not scare you seem like something that you're like, ooh, what if, you know?
I think also a difference that I just clocked is in the feeling of watching, say, like something about like Ted Bundy shit. I think that I used to probably put myself like into the victim role in most mm-hmm. scenes when watching that. And that's probably like a super normal thing to do. But I think now when I watch things like that, I don't do that. And so the feeling is less of like how it feels to be personally in a haunted house and more of like, oh, this is so horrible for this person that I'm watching. And there are like empathetic feelings now that are really like just very uncomfortable that I didn't used to have. And so that's been an interesting shift.
I think that's why I like I Survive. And I think I like I Survived more now as an adult than I did as like a younger person where I'd maybe watch some of the more thrilling stuff.
Sure.
Because I'm like, look at these people who like fucking persevered and survived and like they're telling it themselves and you're like rooting for them. And it like that feels nicer and there's like resolution to that.
When it's victim centered and then it's also like triumph of that victim.
100%. And Diane's kind of synopsis at the end of this NBC News article is that, you know, in the end, despite some of the stereotypes about its fans, that she concludes true crime is much more than a morbid fascination with other people's pain. And if people's boundaries, including the individuals in the featured in the shows, are respected and triggering material is avoided by those who are consuming these programs can actually be beneficial for the emotions of, you know, individuals, groups, communities, etc. But I don't think everybody comes to that same conclusion. That's just kind of where Diane landed, is like a more positive vantage point.
And I hear her because I think that like we've all maybe like massaged some of our religious trauma with cult documentaries.
100%. The other opinion piece I read, even more recent, I was really trying to keep these current because I feel like
these 2 years are pivotal in this topic.
I totally agree. And so The other one I read was an op-ed in the New York Times that came out in September of this year, 2021, that was called True Crime, Keith Morrison, and Me. So shout out to Dateline. That's great. Yeah, lots of NBC featured, you know? Go off.
His voice.
I love it. And it was written by a woman named Jame Costin, and she is the host of The Argument, which is a podcast. So she talks about Dateline starting its 30th season. Dateline, one of the best known true crime programs in America.
And like one of the OGs, truly. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
Truly, but actually one of the things that's interesting, and Keith highlights this in this article, is that Dateline didn't initially start out as trying to do just true crime. They were like reporting on all sorts of stuff, and then that kind of became their lane organically.
They were like, shit, that one episode we did about that missing woman just really bumped the charts. Just only do that from now on.
100%. But I wanted to insert what I liked. One of the things that Jane, this author, did was that she really shed some light on true crime being an extraordinarily popular genre for a long history. So she talks about the English essayist Thomas De Quincey, called True Crime Enthusiasts of the Early 1800s, Murder Fanciers, which kind of like the name of it better, and writing in an 1827 satirical essay, and I quote, "Every fresh autocracy of that class, which the police annals of Europe bring up, they meet and criticize as they would a picture, statue, or other work of art." Which I'm like, true. Yeah. People are out here being like, well, these people didn't do this right. And I can't believe this killer was that stupid. But like the police shit the bed here. And people do that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a lot of armchair stuff.
Yeah. And she, Jane, talks about her own experience, you know, true crimes being especially popular among women. And, you know, looking at the podcast she subscribed to in the documentaries, she's like, it's apparently popular with me. Mm-hmm. You know, she said she read Truman Capote's In Cold Blood when she was a freshman in high school. Obviously, like one of the most famous works of true crime writing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if she's listening to a podcast, it's probably about crime. And if she's reading a book, it's also probably about crime. Mm. And that she's just generally, like, deeply, hopelessly fascinated by stories about crime and criminals.
For sure.
But she has guilt about being a murder fancier. And so I wanted to talk about this because she talks to Keith Morrison. And they kind of talk about maybe the stumbling blocks or, like, ways that you feel like you have to be sensitive more than fucking Diane did. She said that Keith Morrison seemed to relate when she spoke to him. You know, and she also referenced that Saturday Night Live sketch that, you know, played up the voyeurism that was inherent to the genre and told him that she felt like it was weird to enjoy Dateline and the podcast he hosted that focus on, you know, complex stories, betrayal, deceit, and murder. And Keith said, it's weird to say you love doing them. They're fascinating and terrible at the same time. So fascinating, terrible, and often misleading, according to Jane. So she goes on to say that the genre creates a distorted picture of crime in America, and I think this is really important to highlight, that the stories tend to focus on crimes committed against white people, particularly young white women. A really good, very fresh example is Gabby Petito. And that, you know, Instagram influencer, travel influencer, like crime. And the, you know, true crime also often centers on serial killers who generally are extremely rare, and their stories often involve bad policing.
So it's all like network television stuff. Like a white woman who like older white men would think is attractive and like, yeah, sorry, go on.
No, 100%. You know, Elizabeth Smart. You think about
and they're all Lacey digestible Peterson. Stories. It's like which one is like is the best tell.
Yeah. And the focus on exceptional cases comes at the expense of attention on a more common problem, which are those who get away with their crimes because they kill people who are sex workers, homeless, runaway kids, you know, fleeing violent homes, and maybe never reported missing by their families.
And these are, yeah, the victims that like people love to not look at all because it's like more difficult. Yeah.
Totally. And Jane goes on to mention, which I also think is important, that true crime is often uncritical of heavily punitive judicial system, mm-hmm. one in which the boundaries between right and wrong are far clearer than they are in real life, one in which, you know, the easy answer is to sentence the villain to life in prison or the death penalty.
Because it closes the case and Nancy Grace is happy.
I'm fucking Nancy Grace. She quotes the journalist Rochelle Hampton, who said that true crime, quote, frames the justice system as inherently just, and it frames long prison sentences as something to aspire toward.
With the exception of, and I don't know if these count as true crime, I think that they probably do, but like mm-hmm. making a murderer and like programming that is centered around like proving someone's innocence, like Serial as like the OG. And in a meta way, there's even a TV show now with Octavia Spencer and guest star Kate Hudson about a
random pairing.
True crime podcast. There's a crime and Octavia Spencer makes a viral podcast about it. Yeah. Mm. Anyway, so that's happening. Go on.
Totally. And so Jane goes on to highlight that, you know, true crime may be based in reality, but it portrays a fictitious world where every Uber driver is going to kill you, every colleague is secretly a murderer, and the landscape of America is far more violent than it actually is. Mm-hmm. And it is perhaps unsurprising that she said she heard an ad for a security system during an episode of one of her favorite true crime podcasts on a recent morning, which I'm like, yes, I've definitely heard.
That happens all the time.
That too, yeah.
Simply Safe.
Totally. But the makers of true crime are responding to audience demand. And mm-hmm. she's like, an audience, which I am a part of, which I'm like, go off, sister, me too. And when she listens to a true crime podcast or, you know, reads books about the Manson family murders, sure. you know, she's doing it for her own enjoyment. And what she's doing is listening to some people's worst moments.
Correct. That is sticky. Yeah.
Yeah. And so she's like, you know, if I'm like on long runs, I'm waiting for the train and I'm listening to, you know, true crime podcasts like Serial Killers or Crime Junkie and Medical Murders. And, you know, she's like, I'm engrossed in the stories of the worst possible people committing the worst possible acts for my own entertainment. I want the crimes to be brutal. I want the cases to be complex, even, you know, a labyrinth. And then I want to take off my headphones and go on with my day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You still want the Brady Bunch, like, ability to disengage at the end of the half hour.
100%. But for the families that are touched by horrific crimes, the stories of what happened to their loved ones never really end. Mm-hmm. And in an interview with Time Magazine, Rosalie Clark, who's a woman based in Australia, who her brother, stepfather, and mother were brutally murdered in 2014, she said, we're treated as fodder. We're fuel for people's mm-hmm. fascination, which makes me very sad.
It's content in like a content farm kind of way. And I'm wondering, is it only, I guess, when it's a work of fiction that you have to purchase someone's life rights? Like, I don't know enough about like legal things to know like when you're allowed to just like tell someone's story or not.
I think from my understanding, and, you know, dear listeners, correct us, I'm not an editorial genius, but unless you're quoting something, like, or someone, and then you could strike a deal to, like, get the exclusive X, Y, and Z for a book or a tell-all or something, I think it's just journalism. Like, the people who come out of the woodwork and write, you know, books about politicians, they didn't pay to get to do that.
Autobiography.
Totally.
No, you're right.
So in true crime, you know, the victims can recede into the background while the people who killed them are given primacy. And filmmakers make movies about serial killers and the people who hunt them, but rarely do we see the stories of the people they killed, what their lives mm-hmm. were like, what their dreams for the future were, the families they loved. So
it doesn't juice us up, you know?
Exactly. So she asked Morrison, and I loved hearing this, and I loved that this was, like, the kind of stuff she wanted to ask him about. But she asked him how he's able to talk to people in their darkest moments. And he said that when he was a young reporter, an editor asked him to interview the widow of a crossing guard who was hit by a car and killed.
Oh, God.
And he said he came perilously close to quitting. he said, the last thing in the world I wanted to do was to land in on somebody in the moment of her most intense grief and ask all these invasive questions.
Mm-hmm.
But he did it and has done it hundreds of times since. And Morrison goes on to say, the people at the heart of the story are going through the worst thing they'll ever go through. They sit with me and they reveal things about their lives, things they probably wouldn't even tell their close friends. And they're talking about them on television. And it's always been a surprise to me. It's still a surprise to me. It's a privilege and it's slightly disturbing at the same time.
Hmm.
So Jane goes on to say that over the past few years, the genre of true crime has shifted and that she's noticed the podcasts she listens to are showing an increasing willingness to center non-white victims and recognize the real failures of the criminal justice system,
mm-hmm.
which I feel like I've also seen. Mm-hmm. And that non-white people are more likely to be the victims of violent crime and are more likely to experience the very worst of the justice system.
Mm-hmm.
Acknowledging that, you know, reality, rather than focusing exclusively on the visceral but rare, seems like a worthwhile step. She still finds a lot wrong with true crime, but she's continuing to indulge. She says, I don't really have an answer for why, other than my fascination with how and why humans do very bad things to other humans. Yet, I do keep in mind that the victims of those crimes and those who commit them are people, too. Mm-hmm. And she asked Morrison what his advice would be to journalists or writers or podcasters looking to tell the stories of true crime. But what he told her, she said, would apply to anyone who engages with true crime, including herself. So I appreciate this. Keith said, the main advice would be to not forget that these are human beings at the heart of this. Whether somebody has done a bad thing, you know, they were probably just like you or me, a regular person up until the moment when they suddenly weren't.
Mm.
And they committed an act for whatever reason, which caused them to sort of step outside the human experience. I think it's really important, if you're in the business of covering stories about these things, to be very careful, to be respectful of the people involved, and to understand, but not to judge.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was interesting. And it was interesting to hear his side of it. And obviously, he's not going to be someone who comes out like wildly critical of like pays his bills,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. And I feel I'm like there's wrestling, yeah, in those statements even.
But I feel like there was some candor about him even talking about doing that, especially as like a younger journalist and being mm-hmm. like, this fucking sucked and like I didn't want to do it.
No, totally. Hmm.
But I don't know, kind of hearing the perspective of other people grappling with it and like psychological thoughts about the good or the bad of it. And we kind of talked about things that like we don't like to engage in as much just because like straight up we find them like spookier. But mm-hmm. how do you kind of think about your own consumption of this kind of material today? Like, is it something you feel like guilt about, or is it something that you think is like fine, or is there something that you like want more of or less of?
I think more of would actually like, I would like for there to be more like good crime fiction, maybe, like instead of true crime, like could we just have like a few more like really engaging like stories like this that are perhaps not real, so that we're like not actually like putting someone's life on blast, like that could potentially be cool. But I know of course like that wouldn't ever do as well and you can't like have it play out in the same way, but it makes me just kind of think about like how I've shifted from consuming like a lot of like serial killer backstory true crime. And I think that that was kind of probably like the dominant thing that when I was like maybe in my like early mid 20s, like what I was the most interested in was like
mm-hmm.
like a villain origin story kind of thing. And I think it was like a desire to understand like how a person can be like that. And just like an interest in like dark psychology, I guess.
Yeah. But that human was, interest, behavioral psychology, yeah, that kind of thing.
That, yeah. And that was like really the core of the interest. And then I think probably just like some self-defense fear stuff. But
totally.
I think that ethically, I wasn't thinking about it at the time. I think now if I tried to consume the same stuff, I might have like more qualms about it. But I think at the time I was really blind to like honestly even really thinking about the victims. If I'm like totally straight up about it,
I think that's real.
Consuming like Ed Kemper information.
Oh yeah.
With just like truly thinking like, what the fuck happened and is wrong with Ed Kemper? Like,
I mean, so he's a fascinating one. Like, psychologically, it's like, whoa, like, you totally. I got a lot of questions about his brain.
And so I think that there is or has to be like some space for that in like an educational, but I guess it's like a morbid curiosity kind of way. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's totally wrong to like learn about people who did horrible things, but I don't know. I definitely feel a little weird about it. And like, I'm not sure even how I feel as I'm saying it now. And I haven't consumed anything like that recently. It's mostly been like fraud and cults kind of stuff.
Sure. I love listening to scammer shit. I love like hearing people who like fraud things.
LuLaRoe stuff. Yeah. Sure. But like people are shattered from that too. And so like, I guess, yeah, to a degree I am like just consuming your pain. And even in the Real Housewives stuff, like to call back to that like franchises that are becoming more true crime centric. I was listening to a podcast recently where it's called Bitch Sesh, and they had on Ray Sani as the guest, and it's a Housewives podcast, and they were talking about like the shift into true crime, and Ray did like a really nice breakdown on like why she's not like more upset with the housewives for committing these crimes and committing these frauds. And she was basically just like, we have to look at ourselves. Like we're consuming this. And we're watching Maleficent, and we keep acting like we're watching Snow White. And so we're like, why don't these women apologize to the victims? And it's like, we want to hang on to a shred of that, like, we're not enjoying watching a woman who frauded, like, widows and orphans out of millions of dollars. Like, we're not watching that, right?
So interesting, because even you making the comparison about Maleficent versus Snow White just, like, gave me a lot of Disney and, like, Marvel and DC feels about, like, the anti-hero and the villain stories. People want that. Because we've got Joker, we've got Maleficent, Cruella. Like now we're writing, there are all these
Thor
movies
guy,
about,
yeah. Loki or whatever. Yeah. And I would love like a Voldemort origin story where we see all the Horcruxes made Hannibal Lecter style. But yeah, so I think it is something that we're all hungry for, but that we feel weird about, because even in these Disneyfied versions,
yeah,
Maleficent, we like kind of learn why Maleficent wasn't evil. It's not like that she's actually evil and we're sitting with that. We're kind of like learning that it wasn't true. And so I think that maybe there's a tendency to do the same thing when we like learn about Ed Kemper or Dahmer. Like maybe there's like over sympathizing that's happening.
Sure.
In the same way that's happening with the housewives for some people, I think. I think people may be like over sympathizing with Erica. You're probably dumb if that's happening to you. Sorry, but but I think it can happen. And I think that I used to probably do that to a degree, if I'm honest, when I was listening to these serial killer kind of like biographies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I don't know. How do you feel? What do you?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think I also come from this place of just like human interest and like behavioral psychology. And then I also like the puzzly aspect, and it is really satisfying.
Yes, in a Da Vinci Code way.
Yes, and I like, we can't never not mention Dan Brown. He's like the third host
of this
podcast.
There's a new movie coming out, and I wish we could go see it together.
Oh, Oh, I've never seen any of the Da Vinci Code series movies. God bless. Shout out to you.
I haven't either.
See, look at that. We're always supporting, not supporting Dan Brown, our third host, our ghostwriter, Dan Brown.
Oh, my God.
I wish ghost Dan producer. Brown ghost wrote this podcast. That's my fucking dream. No, but I think like. So I like the puzzly part of that. I do find satisfaction and when you get like the closure of like when cases can be solved, especially mm-hmm. if it's a cold case. And I recently listened to an episode of a podcast where the previous host of, so there used to be a podcast that I think was affiliated with Oxygen called Martinis and Murder. And mm-hmm. it's not on anymore, but I was listening to John Thrasher, who is one of the co-hosts on that podcast, speak on another podcast. And he was talking about how he actually had some really positive experiences through doing that podcast where there were some people like family members of the victims, especially if it was something that was like unsolved, who were very grateful for the coverage of the story, especially if it was something that they felt like wasn't getting attention or attention had fallen off. So
and he police was talking, are just like people just bumbling yeah. around sometimes, like not doing what they're supposed to. So sometimes you got to get a podcast on it.
Totally. And I appreciate that. And then I also have heard the flip side of it where I think many moons ago at this point, there was an episode of My Favorite Murder where they do a segment where people write in hometowns, and I kind mm-hmm. of think it was a hometown rather than a story that one of the hosts told that mm-hmm. somebody had written in, but then someone heard this, and it was like a hometown that was basically about her.
Oh, and that feels familiar to me.
And yeah. she was very unhappy about it. And yes. she, you know, she yes, survived.
Do, yeah.
But right. it was like a very traumatic experience. And mm-hmm. so it's like anything. I think there's nuance where some people would be like, thank you so much for this. And some people would be like, this is fucking terrible. And I think it goes to, I guess, doing your due diligence of, you know, knowing thing. What's right. And John Thrasher talked about how they had, because, you know, they're affiliated with Oxygen, so like big network. They had a lot of like legal shit. And there's stuff to say about that, too, because what, you know, when CBS did that big JonBenet Ramsey special a couple years ago, they basically said that the brother did it mm-hmm. and he filed a defamation lawsuit and
sure
won.
Did. Yep.
So I really think my takeaway is that there's like no one size fits, you know, all answer. I do think some of what I appreciate about it as like, you know, single live alone female is that I guess one of the things that's drawn me to the genre the whole time, especially when I hear about like near miss stories, I think I'm particularly interested sometimes in like hearing the serial killer accounts of people who are like, I think I had a brush with this person, but then it wasn't. And mm-hmm. I think about like, how would I defend myself or like yes. red flags to look for? Cause I yes. will admit this, and I feel like you've said this about me before on this podcast, this is just like my strong suit. Like my inclination and vibe is to be like very trusting. And so mm-hmm. I think that's something I'm drawn to of like thinking about worst case scenarios and being like, what would I do? Or being like, what that person did was really smart and I should remember that in case I'm ever in this situation. And I even think about that from growing up. This is kind of dark, but a girl my dad went to high school with, I think when they were in college or like right after they graduated high school, got carjacked and killed. Mm. Oh my God. My dad always used to tell us this story because my dad always used to tell us things that just like you probably shouldn't like scare teenagers with. My dad sure. has this way of like stranger danger when we were younger that like actually was like low-key emotionally traumatizing at points that just like I was like, I didn't need this to be like nailed. And so every time we went to the hardware store, my dad made it seem like it was a real possibility I was going to get abducted.
My parents made me fake a kidnap, like
that's
in
true.
My grandparents' driveway. Like they were like, okay, like now we're gonna practice. And it was me practicing not getting abducted. And my mom came around
maybe
the corner and like picked me up
crime.
like as though she was a stranger carrying me away. And I had to like scream and kick, and then I cried because it was really upsetting. But Just a few months later, a stranger picked me up at the mall and started carrying me away, told him he had to try on a dress. It was weird. And my dad punched him in the face. So I'm happy that we did that drill, even though it was traumatizing.
I mean, that maybe that's part of the reason we're obsessed with it. I never thought about that, but I was like, my dad used to scare the shit out of me when we were younger.
Yeah.
And I remember him telling us this thing. He goes, you know, if somebody ever tries to like carjack you and is like, drive somewhere else, my dad's like, whatever you do, like, don't do that. You're dead. Like, mm-hmm. he's like, run.
No, totally.
Like, don't go to a secondary location, which is too good.
No, you
want to
be
advice.
Shot in front of people where you can be helped.
Yeah. I just always feel like I was too young to hear about, like, a teenager being, like, driven out into a field and killed. But that's
We're all too young for that. Yeah.
That's true. There's never an age in which you're like, now this is cool.
But I wanted to say also, though, like, you were saying, like, as a single female, like, living alone, like, you're mm-hmm. kind of, like, looking for, like, tips or, like, how did this person survive this?
Or even just, like, in the dating game. Like, when I was,
what do I, like, you know, what's a red flag?
Going on app dates or, like, you're meeting up with people you don't know and mm-hmm. you're like, you know, what kind of stuff should I be like, this isn't okay? Because
you went to a different train station that one time. Yeah,
I went on a date one time that the person was like, it was the worst date I've ever been on. It was very off and I was like genuinely scared, and I like fate got on the train, and then I got off and got on a bus and went to a bar where I knew the bartender that was working. And then immediately when I entered the bar, I started crying. But I also felt like that was the safe thing to do in that moment.
It was. It was the right thing. It was.
I don't regret it. And maybe my healthy little dose of fear.
Maybe.
I don't know. But it was, I don't regret doing that. I think it was the right thing to do.
It was the right thing to do. And I was going to say that I feel like I just connected that maybe not anymore, but I think I used to watch like survivalist television. Now I think I watch it to quell my fears about like global warming and if I had live off the land, you know, could I? And so I'm like learning tips and tricks about that. But it used to be, I think, like truly that fear.
If y'all don't know
fear,
this, Jamie and Maddie are light preppers, okay? If y'all don't know about this.
That previous fear of homelessness that I had. Until fairly recently, I think was kind of calmed down by watching those shows because I'm like, you know what?
You're like, I could do it.
I could just be in the woods in a tent. So we're all calming our fears with
I think that's some of it. But I do think the things that I have clocked and like worried about in recent years about things I have consumed or just been more thoughtful about, like I appreciated your comment about, you know, just not even thinking really about the victims before, just being like obsessed with like, what about Ed Kemper's brain, which like hurt me too. But I think it's made me like the conversations around like, is this okay? Have made me more conscientious of whether things are maybe exploitive to victims, you know, thoughtful.
I have a better threshold for that now too, of like noticing it.
Sure. And also being thoughtful about, you know, if certain outlets, shows, things are only covering certain kinds of victims or survivors. And then, you know, I'm not going to lie. I know people talk about glorifying violence, but I kind of think that's like always been a thing, like video games, movies, whatever. I feel
less
sensitive
about that. Do we need to talk about war movies?
Yeah. Well, I actually hold that thought because I do want to circle back on that note about war. There is a pushpin in that. I do have a point about that. But I do think about, like, is it insensitive to, like, make things comedy? Like, My Favorite Murder is a comedy podcast, but it's true crime. And, like, is that positive?
It's complicated.
It is, but then the helping victims and families find answers, the building of community. When things do elevate groups or focus on people that don't get appropriate attention, like, there was a good series about the Alabama child killers, which were like predominantly like kids of color, which like did right. I think that's the one.
That is correct.
And they, you know, didn't get the same amount of coverage at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of think it's like any history. I think it's important to think about, and I'm trying to use this lens more accurately in consuming true crime and probably everything in my life, the older I've gotten. But you think of any historical story and you have to ask yourself, like, who is the narrator and what are they, like, quote, selling?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And to that what are they selling point, I think I've been more conscientious if something, and it's particularly television, I experience this more than I think I do in podcasts, but maybe that's just like what I listen to, if some things feel like cop propaganda.
Yes. And to that point, I think that the true crime genre, while like some parts of it have like definitely been in kind of a Nancy Grace world of being overly like law and order, but that I think that podcasts and like true crime have helped us like maybe have a healthy questioning of the justice system in a way that maybe we wouldn't if we didn't consume true crime. Like we have to see like police work from another angle almost, I think, to like appropriately question it sometimes.
I think some of the true crime podcasts are certainly doing a better job and have always done a better job, albeit not always a great job, but maybe a better job than like the television of like Law and Order and Blue Bloods and NCIS and, you know,
when
all
we realized that that
Chicago
was PD
and, you know, all of these shows that I then you have to be like, oh, man, this is just like about cops. And we're like, who is the narrator and what are they selling? Like, those
are
the questions.
Listen, it's been since Andy Griffith, but there's been some changes. Yeah.
Oh, that's true. Shout out to Andy Griffith.
Don Knotts. I love you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, listen, truly for forever. And then you can think about it too, of like, even like pre Andy Griffith, but you think like Wild West and just like sheriff energy, you know?
Ugh. Yeah. Yeah.
Gross.
Sorry. Sheriffs. Yeah.
I mean, I can't, but I do just want to make this note too, since you brought it up, and I think it's very poignant, and just little bit of interesting psychology. Yes, that is about war. Because when it comes to violent nonfiction, men are from Mars, the planet of war, but women are from Earth, the planet of serial killings and random murders. Mm-hmm. According to an article called Women More Than Men Choose True Crime Over Other Violent Nonfiction, that comes out of like the University of Illinois.
Listen, Champaign. We want the killing to be more personal.
Totally. And so basically there is a study that appeared in Social and Psychological Personality Science where they dug in and found that women are more likely than men to choose a true crime book versus the war or gang violence book. And also that they expected to enjoy it more. But men are like much more interested in like books on war. There was some interesting stuff in there too, that when you just kind of look at reviews, like on Amazon, that, you know, books for true crime and war genres, basically coding based on the username, so not perfect data. Sure. 70% of the reviews for books about true crime came from women. 82% of the reviews for books on war came from men. Mm. And the gender of the author played, you know, no role in a woman's preference for like true crime books.
But it made men discriminate?
They didn't specify that innately in this article, but I assume because that's always been true of all literature, because gross.
Yeah.
Because masculinity.
I see you, F. Diane.
Yeah, that's right. F. Diane. fucking Diane. God bless her. There was also another study where, you know, they gave participants like two books and asked them to choose a book they would read. And, you know, there's true accounts of like a murder of two women in Hawaii versus like two women soldiers who died in the Gulf War, like in an army unit. And so both of these have like two women as the victims. Mm-hmm. But still, like, women are overwhelmingly more interested in the true crime versus like war and violence. And it doesn't matter even if the main characters in all the books are female, and that men would choose like, you know, true crime books about half the time when the other book was like a true war story, even if both had, you know, female characters. So men were slightly more likely to select a true crime book with female characters over the gang book with female characters, but like by a much smaller margin. Basically, men like,
they don't want to see
war.
Women running a gang.
Apparently not. We can't.
I would choose that book. If the women's gang book, there are some interesting true crime things about some women running shit during the cocaine cowboy days in Miami. Check it
Go
out.
Off.
It's
listen.
Fun. I mean, should I even say, I just said it. It's fun, I guess, for me to enjoy that
yep.
that real story that happened to people. Yeah.
But I just, you know, then it comes back to like the self-defense and stuff, and women, but not men, you know, were more interested in, you know, books, obviously, that had female victims, and that the male
participants. Listen, men act like they can't be victims. God.
Well, no, but the male participants like didn't care either way. But the women wanted to read more about female victims. And a lot of people thought maybe that had to do with self-defense kind of vibes, where it wasn't as much of an effect for men. But I do just want to say that then on the flip side. Sure. And I do just want to say then, too, on the flip side of that, then it goes back to like it's history and who's the narrator and what are they selling. Mm-hmm. And like war is obviously not a victimless crime. And there's a lot of, you know, there too, and like consumption of people, like the amount of stories where people are like, you know how many movies have been made where we're like, let's watch Nazis kill Jews. I'm like,
yeah,
it seems like we've spent a lot of time doing that, especially in this country. So that's you know, we've given Academy Awards to those movies. So
well, that's complicated because it like I feel like it's always presented as like we're watching this so we remember this horrible thing so it never happens again.
Couldn't you argue the same about killers?
Well, sure. But I was going to say I think in like Holocaust film situations, I don't think that that's always true, that that's why people are watching them. I think that
definitely not.
Is all of the reasons that we've already talked about.
I think it's all the same reasons we watch true crime. Mm-hmm. Maybe less the self-defense part, truly.
Yeah, but probably that trauma massage.
Yeah, definitely.
And like fear about governments.
I mean, rightfully so.
Quickly, speaking of fear about governments, I would be remiss if I didn't mention. And this is going to be a BYO citation where I'm going to ask the listener to, if it bothers you that I don't have a citation, I challenge you to provide one. So
you've been challenged. God, I fucking love how we do this show. BYO citation. Go off, sister. Okay.
I think it's a new thing. We should do it from time to time.
We're starting now. Okay.
I remembered this and didn't feel like looking it up, basically. So I just wanted to note that true crime, obviously, in our lifetime, like the public's interest in it has like climbed and climbed, especially in the last 6 years and then like even more in the last two. But I wanted to say that I learned that in the 20th century, true crime interest was at an all-time high in 1930s Germany. Just right before World War II, kind That's of right comforting. When inflation was out of control. You can you can see photos of people, probably watch short films also. No, but people in Germany were like bringing like barrel fulls of money to stores to buy regular things because inflation was so out of control that like.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, it takes a barrel of money. Anyway, so I just think it's interesting that in like a heavily right-winged political environment where inflation is really going up and wages are not and there's civil unrest and just that tight, tight right-wing ideology that people become obsessed with stories about people getting brutally murdered. And I just think that there's a through line there that we should all not ignore.
Yeah, I think that that's... like noted.
And when you said that it was also popular in 1800, I was like, whoa, what was going on then? And I didn't really learn about that time ever. So I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't listen. Don't come for me. If you need BYO citation on that too, bitches. But listen.
It's my new favorite phrase.
BYO citation is everyone's favorite phrase. But yeah, I think we've given ourselves some food for thought. I think the moral of the story for me is like, be a conscious consumer about all things, which is always the moral of the story. Who's the narrator? What are they selling? And
is it propaganda?
Is it propaganda? I mean, it could be. So I think, and also, is it like insensitive? You know, mm-hmm. Perhaps you could say that sometimes journalism itself is not a victimless crime. Okay.
Indeed. Let's all remember that Perez Hilton was indeed a form of a journalist. So,
and that was not victimless. I'm so sorry for you, Jennifer Aniston. Wow, he really came for her for years.
And everyone else, the low hands. Yeah, it's true. God.
Ooh, God bless. Well, without further ado, I think it's time we pivot into a verbal game. So cue the vibraphone.
Cue it.
Okay, so we've spoken about how journalism is not a victimless crime. Indeed. And I'd like to center us as victims, or hopefully survivors, you know?
Oh, you know I chased that man away from my window that one night.
Yeah, Jamie and I have very different fight or flight responses, apparently, because Jamie's is fight and mine is freeze, the third, often not included response, where you just pretend to be dead if something seems horrifying. And it's evolutionarily, not it's not helpful at all. You will die. Okay.
Not for a human. Nope.
Right. So I wanted to give us kind of a three choices with rules kind of game.
Excellent.
Where we'll have three separate areas of our life that will be reported on in an investigative kind of podcast series.
Okay.
Long
form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, long form podcast. you know, hopefully we get like good narrators, like you have the Phoebe Judge of it all or something, you know.
Sure.
And that these are going to last for different periods of time or not at all, okay? Mm-hmm. So one of these areas of your life, there will be an ongoing podcast until the day that you die discussing it, okay? One of these podcasts will like be like a short kind of format thing. We'll say like they release, we'll say like two-ish episodes a month for a year.
Okay.
And then the other one of these things, there is not going to be a podcast about. Okay. So the areas of your life in which they will or will not be reporting on, there could be a podcast about your career and all like professional matters associated with.
It's a lot of pressure.
A podcast about your family life and like all ties to that.
Mm.
And a podcast about your dating, romantic, and intimate relationships.
Wow.
I like have a very visceral, immediate answer to these choices.
I don't know.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
But it's more like it would be easier to like not get mad about like a career podcast about me. I think like it wouldn't cut as deep. And so I guess for that reason, I would choose that to be the all-time one, because also at some point I'm going to retire, and but I'm not going to stop having interpersonal and romantic relationships. And so for that reason, they can just talk about what I'm doing in my retirement, what kind of small businesses I'm working on, I guess.
The get-rich-quick schemes of your youth. They'll do like a deep dive into your backlog.
I'm down for that. I think that sounds great. Yeah. I haven't done too much professionally that I'm ashamed of, except one time I did transport that gun illegally. But
Guys, that's truly another episode. That was part of your career. There was an illegal transport of a firearm. Do with that little Easter egg what you will. It's exactly cool with it. As insane as you are like, you're like, surely it can't be as crazy as I think it is. And that's why they're, no, it's as crazy as you think it is.
But I had to check that someone was alive after I did it. I thought I made a horrible mistake.
That's right. Listen. Sometimes, y'all. Sometimes. And that was part of a career. Okay.
Okay, cool. Put it on there. I think it'd make a great show. Oh, my God. And the time that I saved someone from being roofied. There are a lot of good nuggets in the career.
Oh, that's true. Jamie did prevent a roofie at her job one time, too.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, when you're in the cocktail room, boy, a lot of stuff can happen.
That's
right. Anyway, so, yeah, I made my choice. I'm assuming you do that, too.
Yeah, so my...
Like one really salacious dating year podcast, I guess.
Exactly. I kind of hope that they would, like, take a year of, like, just... A
really wild year, yeah.
Just, like, the wildest year of whatever, like, my most interesting dating fodder of yesteryear.
The year you peg. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was thinking in the past, but maybe it's in the future.
I don't know.
We don't know about my life. I just would want it to, I kind of think it would be fun, like if there were a podcast documenting my like hookup history in like of my 20s and like the terrible, like the time I like had to switch transportation because that date was so scary and bad.
Yes.
Like that was a period in time that I was really out there dating a lot of different people. And if on the podcast, even I got more of the backstory on these people, I honestly want to know too. I'm like, do that investigative journalism of people I went out with in my late mid 20s.
Oh my God, please. And do a Where Are They Now for me.
Absolutely. Like, absolutely. Let me know. Like, there's some people I have questions about. LinkedIn
tells them if I look, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you can turn that setting off. I'll show you how. That's true. People can know.
I thought you
had
to pay for it. Just stopped looking. I never search anyone.
No, you can turn it off. You just then can't see who's viewing you if you choose to not
give
that up.
I can't see who's viewing me.
Well, then you're probably incognito. I'll help you verify this.
Okay. It's not for us to workshop right here. Sorry.
Listen, it's not here for us to solve Jamie's LinkedIn browsing problems right now. But
guys, I have 8 connections.
Guys, that's her 8. That's true. But I just, that's important fodder to have. Sometimes you need to know. But yeah, I have one salacious deer. And then honestly, like, I don't have any like family like stuff that I'm like, oh my God, this can't get out. But I worry that times that I've been upset with people, like any kind of record of that could like cause me some problems.
Blow up for you
know?
Sure.
Yeah.
It's more to smooth over constantly. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think that, you know, people need to know the inner working. We don't need a record of times that like you've been, you know, like zesty with family. That seems inappropriate. Mm-hmm. I do want like probably like my like late 20s, one of those like dating years.
Yeah.
There's some salacious content. Listen, dear listeners, if you've got an era or aspect of your life that you would be open to feeling like was perhaps a victimless crime for a small investigative podcast to be made about, oh no, I'm open to it, okay? And you can let us know about that, as always, on the internet via email at whyyourelikethispod@gmail.com, on Instagram at whyyourelikethispod, and on Twitter at WAYLTTweets. And good night, good morning, good day, good evening, whenever you're listening to this. We will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.